is if God gave the Torah to the Jewish people. One question is, what did he give to the non-Jewish people? Are there laws that apply just for them? We're going to see there are. So are we living in two different worlds? Do we have the Jews on one side and the non-Jews on the other, and never the twain shall meet, as they say? Two completely different people, two different worlds. Okay, we have to interact, we become doctors and lawyers and all the rest of it, and accountants, and we've got to go shopping, so we interact, but otherwise no real interaction. And the answer is definitely no. Absolutely not. Jewish people have a specific role, and you may have heard the expression before, we are the Am HaNivchar, the chosen people. How many people don't understand this expression? They think, well, sounds so, I don't know, like racist. I mean, chosen people. So what we're going to look at today is chosen for what? Once we figure out what we're chosen for, then we will discover the important role the Jewish people have in the world, and specifically world history. Let's go to the bottom of page 18. Let's start with Jeremiah the prophet. Ki itcha ani, Nu'um Hashem. I am with you. Says Nu'um means calls out, announces Hashem. Lo shiacha ki eselcha k'vachol ha'goyim. I am going to bring annihilation for all the nations. Asher v'sitcha sham ach etcha lo aseh kaleh. But you will always be there. The Jewish people will always survive. You know, it's actually a good follow-up to that discussion we had the other day. We went to the bottom of page 18, top of page 19. We had a discussion of this Pew Research poll, right? We did a whole class on that. Mm-hmm. Something I've got to mention very importantly. You know, there's all this discussion, will the Jews survive? Jewish survival, you know, continue. It's like a big discussion. We're always talking about it, you know? There was an article many years ago in Life magazine, The Vanishing Jew. And as some pointed out, the Life magazine doesn't exist and the Jews still do. So the magazine that predicted our end is gone. Right, Blech pointed that in an article, which is an excellent point. Having said that, we have a guarantee. An absolute guarantee given to Avram Avinu, given to Yitzchak, given to Yaakov, the Jewish people will always be there. The question is, how big we're going to be, and who's going to be part of it? But there is a guarantee of Jewish survival. Other nations have come and they have gone. As we're going to quote right now, if we didn't already. But other nations have come and they've gone and they've disappeared from the world stage. Did we do this Mark Twain quote yet? Did we do this one? We did it, yeah, didn't we? You know it. Not in this class, do it. Have you heard it before?
Yeah.
Let's look at it again, because it really fits it beautifully. Let's finish off the passage again. I will not bring Elisha upon you, says Hashem, the Jewish people. And by the way, they say this is one of the greatest miracles of Jewish history. What's the greatest miracle that's happened to us? The fact we're still here. After 3,500 years of destructions and exiles and pogroms and Holocaust, the Jewish people are still there. So the famous writer Mark Twain wrote an essay in Harper's Magazine. This is a piece of it. Actually, the whole thing you can see online. The whole thing's pretty interesting. He doesn't leave it as a question, I don't think, if I remember correctly, but we do over here. And he says, look around the world. You see the Egyptian on page 19, second box. The Egyptian, the Babylonian, the Persian rose, they filled the planet with sound and splendor, then faded to dream stuff and passed away. The Greek and the Roman followed, they made a vast noise, they're gone. All these nations are gone. Now you're thinking, 1 second, but we see there's Persians today, and there's Greeks today, and there's Romans today, and they're like, no. There's no relation between them, they're completely different realities. Right? A Greek today who has no connection whatsoever to Greek of old, except maybe living on the same land as those people. Right? The Persians today have no relationship to the Persians of old. There's no connection there. They don't speak the same language. You wouldn't recognize each other. But if Moshe Rabbeinu turned up right now, you'd recognize items of clothing he's wearing. You better talk to him. You could have a discussion of Torah. It's the same people. It's the same It's directly connected to it. Yeah? See, the other nations have gone. There's no relationship. There's people living on those lands and referring to themselves by these names. But besides that, there's no connection there. Other people have sprung up and held their torch high for a time, but it burned out and they sit in twilight or have vanished. The Jews saw them all, they beat them all. And is that always what it was? Exhibiting no decadence, no infirmities of age, no weakening of his past, no slowing of his energies. Speaking for himself, I am. No dulling of his alert and aggressive mind. All things are mortal but the Jew. All other falsehoods pass, but he remains. What is the secret of his immortality? He leaves it as a question. I think he does answer it, actually, in the main essay.
Mm-hmm.
That's a good question. He did like the Jews. He went to Israel. He wrote about his time in Israel. I believe, I remember correctly, I think his daughter married a Jewish boy. But he had some obsession with Jews. There's no doubt about it. He definitely had. He was like, you know. I don't know. I didn't ask. I don't know. I somewhat doubt it.
It's okay. When you ask if she converts, it's like it makes it all better. You can't really convert for love. It's not.
Maybe it could be that she converted beforehand. It's not, you know. And people are motivated by many things to convert. Mm-hmm. See, many things. You're right. You're right in one thing. Conversion has to be authentic. That's for sure.
Yeah,
but it doesn't have to be this.
I see many Jews, many non-Jews also converting, but they convert after they get married. Obviously, they convert for love.
Well, after you get married is different. After you get married is different from before you get married. But I don't know many people. After you get married, actually, is actually much easier. I told you a story about a couple I was involved with.
Really?
Sure. Mm-hmm. Once they're married already, they have kids. I know I was involved with the family. And I used to give classes at the JCC. And there was a lady there. And she would come to the classes every week. And, you know, she didn't look Jewish, you know? Because she wasn't. And she married a Jewish guy. I mean, she had some kind of, like, conversion when she just got married. But she said it was, like, ridiculous. It was, like, a three-week course. They'd, like, cooking classes and one history class. And that was it, basically, you know? And she was older. She was in her probably 40s at that point. She married an older Jewish guy. And the last class, he came in with her, the Jewish partner. He must have been like 6'2", like long blonde hair, like guy in his like mid-late 40s, you know, real like an actor, I can't believe it. And he came in, we got talking, and he had two kids, not Jewish, and they came to classes, not the kids, the parents, and I started doing class in his house years ago. And eventually, after many years, she ended up converting. She converted the kids the same day. Then she got married to her husband because she wasn't legally married beforehand that night. Because she wanted to convert in the morning and then marry and then live together with him. But she had to be married to him, so she got married the same night. So she converted in the morning with the kid. That's a busy day. Imagine that. And I say to her, after like 3 years of studying, she was already like observant. You know, like she knew her stuff. And like, you know, is this something you want to do? She's like, no, I need some more time. I was pushing you. Anyway, she did it. Now she moved actually to an observant Orthodox neighborhood, and kids go to yeshiva. So you never know. You never know where it's going to come from. So that's actually very much related to actually what we're discussing now. Some people are doing it. Yeah, Jen.
Someone told me sometimes, like, if you marry a non-Jew, like, your family has to mourn for you. So
the way it used to be, we discussed it on Shabbos a little bit, didn't we? It used to be in the old days, Jen, where people say Kaddish and Tear Kriya. This is not happening anymore.
Okay.
No. People are still upset, but it doesn't happen anymore. If it did, I mean, everyone would be saying Kaddish now, because unfortunately the intermarriage rate, as we know, is extremely high. Now it's got to a point where it's not something we're happy about, but there's definitely a move to try to bring them back somehow or another and not just completely discard them. Especially if the girl's Jewish, she's going to have Jewish kids. And actually, sometimes once they get married, but listen, I'm not condoning it, but it's going to a point now where most people intermarry aren't doing it because they hate. They just don't know what being Jewish is. That comes from an era where people knew what it was, they went, they learned, they understood for the most part. You know, well, the parents definitely did. And then they completely disconnected from it.
But I know a friend, like their brother, like they think that he might marry non-Jewish.
So that would only happen if they actually engage them a little bit. It's not simple. There's no one. If you're looking for a hard and fast rule, it doesn't exist. You know, it's a very delicate situation. For many families, it's very, very upsetting and painful. How to deal with those situations where one partner, one of your kids, is in that scenario. I met with a couple. This was about a month ago, and the mother called me up frantic. Actually, a friend, she was too embarrassed to call me the mother. Her friend called me about it, And then the mother, I spoke to the mother, and the boy came. The boy was dating a non-Jewish girl, a Puerto Rican girl. Actually, a very sweet girl, actually, for 9 years. Because they couldn't get married, because they didn't want to break up with her. So he dragged her along for 9 years, can you imagine? Poor girl. But they just couldn't. He couldn't do it, you know. And converting, we noticed they came in to talk with me. Should we convert? What's involved? So I went through it. I'm not a converting. I mean, I've been involved in many conversions over the years. Many of my students have ended up converting, even here at Stern. It's happened, or reconverting in that case, I guess. and I sat down with them, and a month later, I went through the whole process, and I said, either you're in, you're out. You can't, you know. Can't drag this poor girl along. Either you're going to convert or you break it off. And like a month later, that was it. After 9 years together, you know.
So the
mother was happy, actually, be so surprised. The guy was Jewish. I believe, and I've mentioned this last class, I believe that most cases of intermarriage, I've never seen a statistic on this, but from my personal experience of 13 years working in this field, I think it's mostly Jewish men, non-Jewish women. I believe that to be the majority. That's what I believe. That's my own personal pontification.
Wait,
yes, Devorah.
Did she want to convert, or was it?
She, when you understand what's involved, converting is really tough. It takes time. It's a commitment. You know, it's not you go and you dunk and you're out. You know, it's a whole big process. You got to, learn, right? You got to start to keep mitzvot. You know,
you
and
it's,
it takes time. You can see your family. You can see your family. You can see your family. That's not true. Absolutely not. Absolutely not. Absolutely. You show respect to them. I know people who say Kaddish. I know a person, in a very sheepish person, a very frum guy who converted and he married you. And say, no, absolutely not. The relationship, listen, going back in history, your family may have disowned you for doing it. One of the reasons we're told to love, there's three groups of people the Torah tells us to love. The convert, the ger, the widow, the almanah, and the orphan, the yatom. Those are the three we're told to love. Ahavta et, and I'll mention these three, the ger, yatom, and the almanah. Why those three, does the Torah say? Because those three have been disconnected, many from their family, because their families would disown them. Now, probably the parents are happy the kids are marrying a Jew. But going back, it wasn't such a great thing. They didn't want the kids to marry Jews either. It wasn't just Jews that didn't want to marry out. They didn't want them to marry their kids either. You know? So they would actually disown their kids. So the Torah says that you have to take the role of their parents. But they can have a relationship with them. Again, it changes. But then all relationships changed. Yeah, absolutely.
The Torah says, I always heard that you're not supposed to have a relationship with your family because... like when they were teaching about gears and stuff in my last school, they're like, you're not supposed to because you may be more willing or you may go back or like your kids.
You can have a relationship with them.
Okay.
Yeah.
So are you allowed to go to the wedding? Like family.
That's a very, very difficult question. That is a very difficult question. And it depends who you ask.
Oh.
The general rule is absolutely not. That's the rule. But to every rule, as you know, there's always an exception. Because if you're there, you're promoting it. There are rabbis who will permit it in certain circumstances if they know that if you don't go, the family's going to fall apart. Okay? So for family members, I've seen rabbis say in certain ways, certain places, and certain times, they are allowed to do it for Shalom Bayit in order to not to... There are people who will give that dispensation. The general rule is no, because if you're there, you're... that's for family. For friends, I don't see any heta. I personally don't see any heta means any permission to go. Because if you're going, you are, you know, you're condoning. Thank you. Condoning. So when it comes to friends, you know, no. No. Family members, I've seen, again, don't have a word for it, but there are big rabbis who will give dispensation certain times and circumstances for that. Yeah. Like as I mentioned, it's a major part of Jewish life, you know? But, okay. So what exactly is the role of the Jew in this world? Well, the fact that Jewish people have lasted this long, as I mentioned, the Gemara says this in Yoma, that it's... one of the amazing parts of Jewish history is the fact that we're still here as a nation. Okay. And that, they say, speaks of our chosenness. The Am HaNivcha. Now, we don't know what we're chosen for yet. We're going to see that in a second. But one thing that speaks of it is the fact that Jewish people are still there is one of the proofs of the miraculous nature of the Jewish people and the chosen nature of the Jewish people. You know? And I brought down a few more non-Jewish sources over here. And even popes have addressed this and said that the fact that the permanence of Israel is a historic fact and a sign to be interpreted within God's design. Here's John Paul II, who had a pretty good relationship with the Jews. It remains a chosen people. Yeah. You know, I heard the chief rabbi Lau speak, and he mentioned, he was the ex-chief rabbi of Israel, ex-chief rabbi of Tel Aviv, he was the chief rabbi of all of Israel, and he said he met with the Pope. And he said when he walked in to meet him, because it was like an official thing, but he went into his residence, whatever. So he went in to meet him, and I was there when he said this. It was a small group I took to see him in Israel and Tel Aviv. And he said that the Pope saw him and gave him a hug or something, or, you know, and showed him love and said, "Ah, my big brother." You know, it sounded like the big brother. You know, we're like the Yale brother. He said, "You're my big brother." That's what the Jews are, you know? Okay, it is what it is. But that's how he seemed to... you can't deny it. If you look at Leo Tolstoy, here's a nice piece worth looking at once. He says, what exactly is a Jew? What kind of unique creature is this, whom all the rulers of the nations of the world have disgraced and crushed and expelled and destroyed, persecuted, burned and drowned, and despite their anger, their fury continues to live and to flourish? He's trying to figure it out. It doesn't make sense. So what is this Jew whom they have never succeeded in enticing with all the enticements of the world? Okay, now they're doing a pretty good job of it. Whose oppressors and persecutors only suggest that he deny and disown his religion and cast aside his faithfulness? The Jew, he says, is the symbol of eternity. He's the one for who so long had guarded the prophetic message and transmitted it to mankind. Now that's actually a very good point. He was saying things I don't even realize he was saying. We'll say that again. He has guarded the prophetic message and transmitted it to all mankind. Okay? And then he says such people can never disappear. As I said, HaKadosh Baruch Hu promised Avraham Avinu way, way before this, thousands of years ago, the Jewish people would always be there. Okay? And we've got a quote from Churchill as well. You can look at that in your own time. And academics have puzzled. Let's turn to page 20. Let's try to figure out, so what are we chosen for exactly? So to do that, let's look at a famous story from the Torah. And we know that Yaakov Avinu, Jacob, had to flee from his evil brother, twin brother, Esau, right. And along the way, he arrived at a place, a mountain. It was Mount Moriah, the place where his grandfather had bound his father, Isaac Yitzchak, to the altar. And he laid down, and what happened? He had a dream. By the way, dreams, we'll do a whole class just on dreams, God willing, at some point, I'd like to do that. And dreams play a major part in Jewish history and Jewish life, actually. There's 10 dreams in the Torah without which the Jewish people would not be here. This is one of them, by the way, the prophetic dream. You know, remember that Joseph had dreams, remember that? And then Pharaoh had dreams, and Joseph interpreted his dreams, and then his two people had dreams. And there's a lot of dreams, these are real dreams. So we'll see what a dream represents later on. It's actually a form of, has an element of prophecy attached to it. It's actually called a 60th of prophecy. But we'll discuss that another time. Where if he has a dream, and in the dream, he sees a ladder. And what's on the ladder?
Angels.
Angels. What are the angels doing?
Going up.
Very good. Very good. They're going up and they're going down. What would you have thought? Angels go down and up. Not up and down. Where are the angels from? The angels from the heavens, right? They should be going down, and they should be going up. And we're told they were going up, ascending, and they were descending. What's up with that? Is that a good question? It's not my question. Rashi mentions it, and the other commentators mention it as well. What's the answer? Anyone know?
Yeah.
We don't create... Well, we actually do create angels. These angels weren't created, they were actually given. Devorah? Right, they were protecting him. And why then did they have to go up?
Because the other ones were coming down and protecting the rest of
them. From which wish of the way?
In Eretz
Israel. Very good.
Eretz Israel.
That's very good. He was leaving Israel, and he was going to outside of Israel. There's different angels in Israel and outside of Israel. The ones in Israel are Israeli, like rushing him, like honking, get on with it, arguing with people. You know, they had to leave. And the new angels from outside of Israel who were polite and respectful. No, right? So they had to come, they took over, okay? So the angels were with him the entire time, is the idea over here. That's one explanation anyway. Here's another one. The Midrash says, the Rabbi Chiya and Rabbi Yanai, one explained, they ascended and descended the ladder. Another said that they ascended and descended on Yaakov. What does that mean? On the ladder, or actually on Yaakov. So they say that they saw this amazing thing. There was Yaakov in this world, and there's Yaakov in Shemayim, in the heavens, a spiritual version. By the way, it's going to apply to Yaakov, it's going to apply to all of us. That's why this is important. And they saw a likeness of the two. Yaakov down here, and they were amazed at how similar the two were. The spiritual perfected Yaakov in Shemayim, and the physical perfected Yaakov in this world, and they were amazed. Says Rav Chaim of Volozhin, what is this about? And he says, Shahadam Hashalem Karui Ikrohu Natu'il Mala B'Sherish Nishmaso. A person's complete is planted in the world above, and that's the source of his soul. And he passes through these spiritual domains until the lower part of his soul enters his body over here. It's the lower of the worlds. We'll discuss that another time. Okay. And therefore, they saw that his soul was a part of Hashem, and he was connected to the spiritual realm. And therefore, there is this rope. Yeah, this chevel that is connected. Nachlatosh ikro kashur natua. There's a rope that connects us to our spiritual selves in Shemayim. And he saw that what you do down here affects your spiritual nature up there, that the two are reflecting one of the other. What you do down here affects your spiritual self in Shemayim. So what are we doing in this world? We're perfecting this world in order to affect the spiritual world. We affect the spiritual world. That's the way it works. What we do down here is like a rope, and we are connected to the spiritual world. What's the idea of that? So what is the role of the Jew? So a rabbi I'm a big fan of, he passed away at a young age. He wrote some wonderful books. Rav Shimshon Pinkas was his name. I have many of his classes on CD in my car, actually. And his books. He wrote a great book on Shabbos that I use a lot for another course over here. And he says, what's the idea? What's the intention? What's the purpose of this nation, the Jewish people? I remember we're a very unique nation, that we're the only nation that actually were created directly by God. Other nations kind of like get together, like America. You get together and you create a nation. The Jewish people are different. The Jewish people were created by God. There's a reason why. We weren't just a random band of people. We were taken out of Egypt and made a nation by HaKadosh Baruch Hu. If God makes us, that's for a specific purpose. It doesn't mean we're better or worse, but we have a unique, specific role. That's the chosenness. Are you following? The chosenness, we have a unique and specific role. What is the intention or purpose of the nation? And he says they should be a singular nation in the land of Israel. That's our natural habitat, by the way. The fact we're outside of Israel is not a good thing. Our natural habitat is Eretz Yisrael. And the Shekhinah, Hashem's presence, should be there as well. That's what we're called, he says, Knesset Yisrael. We're an assembly of Israel. That's referring to this spiritual kingdom as well. And we're meant to reflect. He has a big thing on this. He speaks about this a lot as well. We're meant to be the reflection of God in this world. Just like the sun reflects onto the moon, yep, onto the world, Hashem reflects onto us, and we're meant to shine the light to the rest of the world. That is the role of the Jewish people. This is also, by the way, the reason for anti-Semitism. It's all rooted over here. Anti-Semitism, I'm sorry to tell you this, in one way or another, until Mashiach comes, is always going to be there. It's a natural state in this world. You can do all the symposiums, all the seminars, you can write all the books, you can put up all the museums you want. A natural aspect of this world is anti-Semitism. Not that we're happy with it, and we don't want it, and we want to lessen it, and it's worth fighting to lessen, But it is a natural state. If you understand the role of the Jewish people in this world, you'll understand that it has to be that way. Actually, you know, it's an interesting thing. How far does antisemitism go? Well, it goes right back. Right? We know that Yaakov Avinu had to deal with people who wanted to kill him, wipe him out, right? Lavan wanted to kill him. But it goes back to Har Sinai, yeah? Har Sinai is Mount Sinai, right? But they say that Har Sinai is related to another word, which has a slightly different letter, actually, which is Har Sina. That's a sin. A shin becomes a sin in the dark, but Har Sina is hatred. Mountain of hatred. Mountain of hatred.
So Har Sinai comes from...
No, no. Har Sinai is a place. So they take it, they do a play on words, the Gemara, and says that Har Sinai is related to Har Sinai, mountain of hatred. Why would that be? The great experience of giving the Torah, why would that be? So the Gemara says, because anti-Semitism was a natural part of the world once the Jewish people became the chosen people, which is what happened to Har Sinai. Why would that be? Mechitesa, why would that be? Because the Jewish people became the moral voice in the world. That's who we are. And no one likes to be around the goody two-shoes. You know? I don't believe that. I don't believe that. Where they go to some places, they do very, very well. Many countries, they do very, very well, and they've been left alone. They've had difficult... Listen, many nations have had difficult times over history. But the Jewish people, it's like ongoing for always. Constantly, wherever we go, we're pushed out. But it doesn't stop. It's not like one small thing. It's not like a century or a millennium. It's like constant. Why is that? What's the depth behind that? There's always hatred in the world towards other nations as well. I'm not saying we're the only ones who are hated and go through difficulties. I'm saying that it's part of our condition, part of the Jewish condition, a theme that runs right through. So what is the reason why? And the reason is because the Jewish people are the moral voice in the world. That's what we're meant to be anyway. Whether we've lived up to this is another discussion altogether. We're the moral voice in the world. You know, I'll give you an example I like to give. You know, let's say, you know, you've met my daughters now from last Shabbos. So let's say my older daughter, you know, when she was younger, would say, to her, okay, go, Racheli, go clean the room. Go clean the room. You made a mess, go clean up the Lego or whatever, the Polly Pockets. Have you seen those things? Little tiny, like, oh my God. It's like the toys getting smaller and smaller, you know. I just vacuum them up and throw them away. I don't clean them anymore. I'd rather vacuum them up and throw them away and spend money on a new one than pick up every one of these little tiny things, you know. Like, suck them up and dump them. Like, where are my toys? I don't know. Look under the couch, you know. So I say, go clean the room. So what does the average kid say? No. Well, I'll do it later. So I'm like, you want to get dinner tonight? You want to have dessert? You want to come with Abba out? You got to say, tidy up. Like, no, I don't want to, you know. I'm the same with my wife, by the way, you know. I'm like, no, I don't want to. So she's like, go do it. So eventually, my younger daughter will be like, oh God, all right, whatever. We're gonna get out of here. So she will say, I'll do it. So I'll do it. And she goes to clean it up. What does the older daughter do as she walks past her? She gives her a smack like that. Why? Why would you give her a zets like that? Why'd you have to give her a smack as she walks? She's doing a job for you. Why? Because she's making you look bad. Because she knows she's meant to do it. And the younger daughter doesn't want to hurt the older daughter. She's like, I just want to get this job done. Like, my job is to get the job done. It just happens to be. So what happens is, I believe that simple story is the, an analogy, I should say, is the root of it, really. The Jewish people are meant to be the moral voice of the world. I mean, you see it. You can't miss it. You open up any newspaper. As I said, a million Hutsis and a million Tutsis, and everyone's killing each other, and you got all these other terrible atrocities in Africa and the entire world, right? The Western world as well, right? And boycott Israel. You're crazy. What are we doing? You're like, you know what we're dealing with? Do you know how difficult it is and all that? No. And they'll talk about Israel and perpetrating and crimes. And the truth is, it's not pleasant and it's unfair. But the Jewish people have always been under the microscope. We've always had this strong role of being looked at as a moral, and it's not always easy. It can be downright difficult and frustrating at times. But when you identify as a Jew, actually even if you don't, they're going to see us that way. And that is the role. We've got to fulfill our role as a moral code and a light. I use that expression specifically, as we'll see in a few moments. A light unto the nations. That's what we're really doing. We're reflecting Hashem, and they see us as God's representatives. Actually, Rashi mentions somewhere that when people hate the Jewish people, they're actually hating God. When they want to hurt the Jews, they actually want to hurt Hashem, because they see us as God's representatives. By the way, even if we don't want the role, we still have it. We inherited this unique, special, powerful, but challenging position from our ancestors, you know? And the sad thing is, you can run, but you can't hide. You know? We can run from it, we can't hide from it. It's a, it's the essence. It's the idea of chosenness, ama nivcha. So how do we do this? So we follow the mitzvot, and we become light to the nations. They should see, what should it be like? They see us, so it's meant to be. They see us, and they're meant to be, wow. That's how a person is meant to be. That's godliness. That's what they're meant to see. Not when they see us and be like, oh, so that's how you cheat in business, right? That is not the way it's meant to be. So that's how you set up a Ponzi scheme. And it's a terrible, by the way, I'm very clear with you, based on what we're saying, we should appreciate the worst sin, the worst avera a person can do is a chilul Hashem. Consider it worse. Worse than murder. Chilul Hashem. Right? A desecration of God's name. The word chilul is related to the word chalal, which is a void, a hole, a vacuum. Right? Chil Hashem. They say, oh, it's a Chil Hashem. What is a Chil Hashem? You're desecrating God's name. You're desecrating it. What does that mean? That means they look at you and they say, oh, so that's how Jews act. So they don't say that. They say, oh, so that's what the God of Israel is all about. Oh, that's what Judaism, that's what Torah is. You know? Oh, ergo, that's based upon this. Because we're meant to be this light that people are going to look at, whether it's a Jew, secular Jew, today especially, or a non-Jew. They're going to look at us and say, like, wow, that's how Jews are meant to act. Not, so what's the opposite of Chil Hashem, i.e. the best mitzvah? It's always reflective. Kiddush Hashem. Right, so if Chil Hashem is the worst, the Kiddush Hashem is considered the best. That's the sanctification of God's name. The Kiddush Hashem is the sanctity of sanctifying. People say, oh, wow, Jewish God is great. You know, they see us helping other people, you know, giving aid, acting in a certain way, not cutting in traffic, helping a person. Right? They look at us and it reflects, and you don't know how it's going to affect anyone else. So our role is to be out there, which is a big question actually. We're meant to be dispersed around the world. I mean, ultimately we're meant to be at home in Israel. But one of the reasons, I should say, we were dispersed was that we should go out and they should see us. That's what one of the commentators says. The reason we're in Golus is to go out so these other nations can see us, and actually the converts, potential converts, can see us and want to become part of our people. That's what it's, that's what it's meant to be. Yeah.
I have this really kind of long-term question. Why, like, a lot of people say, I don't want to be Jewish, I don't want to do this, and a lot has to do with this. Like, shouldn't it be that God can burn honoring God's name and everything come with it, not the streets flow? Shouldn't that be enough as it is, and not say, oh, by the way, because I chose you, also, people are going to want to kill you? Like, why would you want to be Jewish?
It's
not, if they're going to kill you because of it?
Okay. So being Jewish is not about being killed. That's being Jewish is not about being killed. I'm saying that one of the reasons anti-Semitism exists, one of the main reasons, the root of it, is that we have this role in this world. My point is, we don't like anti-Semitism. We don't want it to be there, and you can fight against it, and you can go march all you want, and you can write all the articles, and everything you want to be. By the way, the real way to fight anti-Semitism is Semitism. How do you fight anti-Semitism? By being Jewish. That's really the answer for it. That's the way it's meant to be. People have tried many times to remove themselves from Judaism altogether, and that doesn't help. Actually makes it worse. Semitism is the way to fight it. The more acts of defiance we do, spiritual acts of defiance that we do, we have to protect ourselves as well physically. But that's the better way for it to be. But it's just that it's part of the condition that we should be seen. That we're meant to be seen this way. We're meant to be a light. Again, just like the sun reflects onto the moon, he says, and the moon gives light, so too we're meant to be the reflection. It's not easy. I'm not going to pretend it's easy. Yeah.
So then are we like responsible for every like bad thing that's happening in the world?
No, we are not. Absolutely not. We are not responsible for every bad thing that happens in the world. People are given free will. Other nations will decide to be part of it and not be part of it. For example, famous question on Egypt, Mitzrayim. Hashem told Avraham Avinu, your descendants would be in a land not theirs, the strangers in the land. So then why were the Egyptians punished for housing us? Well, first of all, I didn't say which nation. They stepped up and took the role. And they made it really bad. It was meant to be challenging, but they made it like really terrible. They had people have free will. Nations have free will. They could decide. They can decide whether they want to learn from us, what they want to do with us, how they want to treat us. I mean, we have to live right now in America, which is a great nation. They treat the Jewish people very, very well, thank God. And we haven't had it this good in thousands of years. I mean, ask anyone who came from Russia from 30, 40 years ago and say, what was it like to, you know... What was it like 30, 40 years ago in Russia? 20 years ago, I don't know. Like, you want to teach Hebrew to someone, you want to be Jewish? Put in prison. I mean, we can't even fathom what, you know. You wanted to work in America, came to Shabbat, I'm not working, they fired you. Now you get yourself a nice Jewish lawyer, you sue him and you take over the company, whatever it is, you know. It's like, we have it very, very incredible over here. I mean, with that comes its own unique set of challenges, as we're seeing, of what comes with being treated so well. We get too comfortable, which is another discussion we can...
I heard that like natural disasters are like not specific things viewable, like natural disasters.
Okay, very good. Natural disasters are not very good. Natural disasters are not caused by Jews. Let me be very, very listen very carefully because I want to clear this very, very well. I want to clarify. I don't know what your rabbi was saying, but I'll tell you what the Jewish sources do say.
It had to do with the.
Let me finish it off because I don't want to get misunderstood. Natural disasters do not come from. However, when natural disasters do happen, we have to learn from them. It's different. Hear the difference? We are not the cause in any way, shape, or form. I mean, that's what they want to blame us for that. I mean, you know what? They will be blaming us for actual natural disasters. There was an avalanche, right? There was a flood. The Jews. Absolutely not. We are not the cause. The Jewish people are not the cause of natural disasters. Maybe humanity as a whole. We don't know. We don't understand. However, when natural disasters do happen, we're meant to learn from them. It's meant to give us an awakening, right? When you see lightning, it's meant to awaken you a little bit. You know, the things that happen naturally in the world, we're meant to see and we're meant to learn something from it. I'll give you a personal example of this. Give it a personal example. A family member of mine and a family member of my wife had a miscarriage on the same day. It's unusual. Close family member of both my wife and myself. Listen, in the observant Jewish world, we have a lot of kids. You know, they see one in four, you know, babies is a miscarriage anyway, whatever it is, statistics are. So it happens to be miscarrying babies is higher, but whatever. It's still difficult and painful and very, very upsetting, obviously. And we were freaking out. We're like, wow, it's like, we both, on the same day, so I called my Rav, and I was freaking out, you know? And I said, what does this mean? Are we the cause of this? Because we're like the only connecting factor, these two people know each other. And he said, don't be ridiculous. Like, what are you talking about? You're not the cause of it. However, there's something you should learn from it. Now, what that is. And that's everyone's own personal spiritual reckoning, whatever you want to call it. Cheshbon HaNefesh, that we want to put on it. That's a personal thing. You're not the cause of it. You can still learn from it. When tragedies happen, it's like, what is that saying? What does it say about us? About how we help other people? You know, whatever it can be, you have to learn something from it. And the commentators say, there's a famous Rabbi Hanal that says, even a flood happens the other side of the world, it's not because of us, but we have to say, wow, you know what, it's happening there, it could happen here. And what does that mean for us? What does it mean for the way we treat other people? So we have to learn from these things.
Why?
That is very different.
Like, if it's not because of us, then
it should affect us. We're saying that naturally it may not. There's a flood in India, right? A million people are wiped away. Right, so we, you know, then we, you switch channels, right? You turn the radio, right? You just, you go off the website, whatever it is. Okay, next. So they're saying it shouldn't be like that. When you hear these kind of things, you mean it should enter your head and your consciousness, you feel something. I'm not saying forever. I'm saying you walk around mourning, but there's a certain spiritual awakening, some thought process that should enter your head. People are suffering. It shouldn't just wash over you. It does, but it shouldn't. We should, it's there to, we should learn. We don't know why it's happened. Why it happened, we don't know. Why bad things happen to good people, we don't know the answer to. That's the honest truth. But when it does, we still think about it. It should still have an impact upon us. So I think what your rabbi was saying, I'm assuming, it's not that we're the result of it, but if it happens, we should take it on board. The whole world should, not just Jews, but it should affect us in some way. It should be more than just a fleeting news story. It just comes in and out of the news flow, you know? Like, the news is always like terrible tragedies, and then a panda is born, like, in China somewhere. Like, they always put it together. I never got that. I'm like, tell you that, 5 million people dead, and Chow Chow the panda has just been born in a zoo in Xinjiang somewhere. I'm like, how did that become the punchline? I never really, you know what I'm saying? Always like, start with the panda, and then get to the terrible stuff. Right? Start with the terrible stuff, and then go to the panda. And that's how they leave. They went, you know what? It ain't that bad. A panda was born. I'm like, you know what? Don't leave me in with that. Don't end with a punchline. You should have like a little bit of, you know. By the way, I have nothing wrong with pandas. You got to be careful. There are a lot of panda lovers out there. They are very offended. People wiped out people, nations, no problem. Panda, don't mess with. So I'm not starting with pandas in any way, shape, or form. Yes.
They always teach us that, like, if something happens in the world, it's because a nation did something to the Jewish people also.
Okay, I'll say it to you very, very clearly.
No, not because of the Jewish people, but they did something to the Jewish people.
We have no idea why Hashem decides to deal with certain nations the way they do.
But we
didn't
teach that.
I don't know why they teach a lot of things in schools. We have no idea. I'm telling you what Jewish philosophy says. We don't know why Hashem puts certain nations through certain things. But the Jewish people have to learn something from it. And somehow, some way, there's some residual effect that should affect us as well. But we don't know why any nation goes through anything. It could be, maybe yes, maybe no. We don't know. But the Jews are not to blame for it. That's my main point. Jews are not to blame for it, that's for sure. Okay. So once again, let's understand this. The Jewish people have a unique role. Let's jump to the bottom of the page. So let's look at the very famous quote of Isaiah the prophet, chapter 42:6. And he says, Ani Hashem, Karaticha, Betzerek, Vechazek Biyadcha, I am Hashem, I've called you with righteousness, and I'm going to strengthen you, your hand. Vasrefa Tzachel Lebrit, Am Or Legoyim, I'm going to make for you a light to the nations. A light, an Or Legoyim. We are meant to be a light to the nations, where we act, the way we treat people, the way we do things. We're meant to bring light. So they look at us and they want to emulate us. And it could be that if they aren't doing good, it could be because of us. That could be. If they choose bad, it could be because of us, because we're not representing God well in this world. That could be. That could be. Consequences we don't know. But it could be they look at us and they say, oh, the Jews do it, so I'll do it too. You know? That's our role. And the Torah itself describes us, V'atem t'yulim mamlechet kohenim v'goy kadosh, says, in the Torah, we're meant to be a nation of priests. The whole Am said to be a nation of priests. Right? V'goy kadosh. We're a goy. We're a member nation of the world. But we're a holy nation. What does holy mean? We're separate, distinct, apart. We're not the same. It's a specific role that we have. Let's see the Sforno on this. We're meant to instruct the other nations. V'atem t'yu li mamlech ha'konim, u'v'zeh t'yu segula mikulam. You're going to be more precious than any other nation. Ki t'yu mamlech ha'konim la'vin la'horod la'chol ha'min la'anshui l'kroi kula b'shem Hashem. The other nations should see us and call out to Hashem. That's what it's meant to be. I'm not saying this has happened, but this is, I mean, there have been times in history where it did happen, but this is where it's meant to be. One of the examples of time where it did happen? Anyone know? One of the best times for the Jewish people was... very good. Time of Shlomo HaMelech, Solomon, King Solomon. Right? That was, it was actually, it was, the Jewish people were doing so well at that time. And the other nations, they didn't accept converts because the Jews were doing so well, they thought, well, of course they want to convert. They were, they didn't trust the sincerity of a convert because the Jews were doing so well. It was like so good to be a Jew. It's hard to even understand this, right? But it was so perfect, so good. That was actually the highlight of Jewish history, the time of the first base of Mikdash. But even then, we messed up. Yeah.
I don't understand how that's allowed to not accept converts.
Right. So it's not that it's allowed. We accept converts. We love converts. Right? Accepting a convert, the special mitzvah, we love the convert. It's just that, I mean, there's some communities today, for other reasons actually, that don't accept converts. Let me be very clear with you. Judaism is very clear. A convert is considered to be of extreme importance to the Jewish people. Actually, one of the reasons they say the Jews went into Galus was so that people would see us and want to convert. And if you look back, I always point out, open any Chumash. You have Hashem's word over there, you have the Torah. What do you have next to the Torah? Unkelus. Unkelus is always next to Hashem's word, the Aramaic translation. Below that is Rashi. Rashi is always below, but Unkelus was there. Unkelus was a convert. He was a Roman. Right? From actually royal Roman nobility. No. You know? So the Jewish people will always, there's a mitzvah to love the convert, you can't offend the convert. You can't tell a convert, this applies to Balchuv as well, by the way, oh, you used to be this, you used to be that. Right? The Torah, description of the Torah being given, was given to Parshas Yisro, who was a convert, the first convert to Judaism. And that's what the Ten Commandments are mentioned. So we absolutely, however, there are certain times, supposedly that was a time, when the sincerity of the convert was challenged because of the circumstances we were in. There was a certain time in Jewish history, and that time passed.
But the Torah never says, like, you have to accept converts most of the time, and sometimes you don't have to.
The Torah says you have to love the convert once they've converted.
Okay.
Once the convert has converted, they're in, it's a mitzvah to love them. And the reason is because they have no, maybe their family have disconnected from them, they're starting a new life, right? It's a difficult thing, it's a mitzvah to love them. But we don't go out evangelizing, bringing converts in. We're not doing the, you know, the witnessing at the door. You don't see rabbis banging on non-Jews' doors saying, hello, I'm here with my Bible, and I'd like to talk to you about following the laws of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. There's a thing called mitzvot. We don't do that. Right? Actually, to convert, we push away with one hand, marachik with one hand, and makarav with the other. We pull closer with the other. We don't push for it. If you want to do it, fine. You don't have to, because you're fine as you are. You are fine as well. We don't push to bring converts to our people. Right? Because you don't need a convert in order to get to the next world or to have a relationship to Kodesh Baruch or to God. So we don't push for it. Once a person decides to convert, and they convert, then things change. Then there's a mitzvah to love them and to treat them as equals among our people. But to bring them in, it's a very difficult, challenging thing. They've got to want to do it themselves. Right? We don't
but
just...
these people wanted to do that.
So we were saying the idea is the sincerity of wanting to do it may not have been so clear because it was so good. In other words, if I say, if you convert, I'll give you $5 million. You know what I'm saying? We were suspect. At that time, it says less about the convert than it does about the time that this was going on. You know? Now there may be one community today who doesn't accept converts.
Which one?
Right?
Sure.
A certain community will not accept converts. And that's not a case of religiousness. That is a defense because they found that there was intermarriage here in America. And they saw that a lot of people were dating non-Jews, hoping to convert them and all this kind of thing. So that was for different reasons. That was more of a self-preservation than anything else. But even the most religious of religious will accept converts. No? And once they're in, it's a whole different relationship. Yeah.
Wait, but when you say accept converts, do you mean like actually allowing them to convert?
To convert, yes. Accept converts, I mean accept them as to convert, actually become Jewish.
Okay.
That's what I mean. Once they converted, it's a mitzvah to love the ger, the yosam, the amana. Absolutely. That's a mitzvah in the Torah. That is a Torah mitzvah. Once they're in. But do we send that you would have thought, well, if that's so great, then bring them in. And there's no. There's no mitzvah to start dragging me. I know people have been in conversion programs a long time, and yet they're like, you know, it's not for me. And they're like, okay. Not for you, not for you. Yeah.
I heard that in the Israeli army, that like they started doing like a lot of conversions for a lot of Russians that were in Israel.
Yeah.
They like squeezed into the country, rather than weren't really like halakhically Jewish. But I was thinking that even if they didn't have a proper conversion, and then they raise up their kids to believe that they're Jewish, and their kids grow up like traditional, and like two generations later, if the kids are still traditional, their great grandkids know they're Jewish.
It's proving to be a challenge.
To
see the real, it's becoming a challenge. In certain, I'm not saying that is, but in certain circumstances, I believe actually one of the main challenges we have today in general are people walking around who had conversions, and even they know it's a joke. I speak to these people, I know them, I speak to their spouses, and say their conversion was nothing. And they're walking around thinking they're Jewish. It's a big, big problem.
Why is it a problem?
Because
then you're stuck.
It's coming difficult to know who is and who isn't. This is one of the big challenges in our day and age. A lot of people walk around thinking they're Jewish, but actually they're not. Big problem.
So then how do you know? Like,
it's becoming more difficult to know. It's you're having to basically rely on. It used to be you knew. You knew the family, you knew where they came from. Now it's becoming extremely difficult to know the quality, when, where, how. It's really. You got to have. That's why it's very. I always tell people, go through conversion. If you're going to do it really, really well. And if you're not sure, then just do it again. You know that famous. There's a famous comedian out there. He converted to Reform, then he did a convert conservative, and then he did Orthodox. You know, and I was a chassid. You know, there's this. You know, you go to many synagogues. By the way, you go to many synagogues. I always tell people. Fine, I was talking to someone in shul recently. He's dating a convert, and he's like, you know, will I be accepted? This, that, the other. I said, look around the shul. He didn't my shul. In my shul, there's two people in my shul are converts. Right? You never know. One of them, you really never know. I'm looking around. Can you see any converts today? He's like, I don't know. I'm like, you're looking at some very closely. You have no idea. You know? It's amazing the change that can happen. These people are completely integrate, become part of the community. You know? Marry girls. I mean, I got someone in my community who was a convert, married an FFB. Got from religious home. My father's like a, you know, from birth.
What?
From birth, FFB. You ever heard that before?
No.
Really? Oh, I gotta teach you this. Oh, one second. I gotta do this. You can't go through life not knowing this. This is crucial.
You got FFB. You don't know this. You have FFB is from birth.
Yeah.
Okay. You people are BT, Baal Tshuva. Okay. He's a BT. She's a BT. Then you have Baal Tshuva is a person who becomes religious later on in life.
No one calls Baal Tshuva BTs,
though. So everyone calls them BTs.
I've never heard that.
Yeah, he's a BT. She's a BT. BT is Baal Tshuva. They became a Baal who did Tshuva. They grew up non-observant. They became more religious. Then you have the FFB. They're from birth. Then you have the ZBT. You have the zealous Baal Tshuva. They're the ones who like become extremely religious, start telling you off, you're not religious enough, you know? Everyone goes through that phase a little bit.
OTD.
Off the Dera. That's what the father meant. OTD. Yeah. Well,
like I'm saying, off the Dera.
Off back on again.
OTD.
Exactly. Is that used to be like doctor? Now you get this before your name. This is like the. You haven't seen it. Oh, this is important. You got to know this. You ever heard this before? Oh, this is very important. Now you'll know this is. Oh yes, he's a BT. He's a BT. Right, BT. What else? There's more. There's more. What else is there? What? Oh, LOR is your local Orthodox rabbi.
Yes.
Also, you got to ask your LOR, your local Orthodox rabbi.
So now I know I need to ask what is he? What I mean?
That's sure it is. What? It's the zealous Baal Tshuva. They're like zealous. They're like, you know. When they first year they become religious, they become, you know. It's a good thing. But it's just like a. Okay. Have a good day.